Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast, bringing the latest apologetics information and equipping you to be the best that you can. Today, our topic is going to be Islam, something that's been in the news lately, especially with the Boston bomber. And my guest is a former Muslim himself, Nabeel Qureshi. Hello, Nabeel.
Hey, how you doing, Nick?
Well, normally I start off with a show of a guest with asking you to tell a little bit about themselves, and for you, I think this is extremely important. Now, you once would have considered yourself a devout Muslim, right?
That's correct.
Okay. What happened?
Well, it's a story that took many years, but essentially what happened was I started off very, very devout. I used to try to share the Islamic message, which is called Dawah, with Christians. I used to challenge them on their essential beliefs that Jesus is God or that he died on the cross. And I used to share with them the Islamic beliefs about Muhammad and the Quran. And in the course of this, I ran into a friend who was able to start responding to my attempts to bring him to Islam. And he was able to share with me the historical evidence for the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. In the process of that, we looked at the evidence for Islam more carefully as well. And as the years progressed, I realized that the strength of the Christian case is much, much more sound than the case for the Islamic position. And so I asked God for some guidance, and he gave me some dreams and visions, which led me to accept Christ as my Savior.
Yeah, I've been told that having dreams and visions is very common for ex-Muslims, that many of them will have dreams and visions of seeing Jesus, some of them not even expecting it whatsoever. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. Lots of people have received dreams and visions, which ultimately got them to accept the Lord. There was a statistic in a survey that was carried out by Horizons International, a ministry out of Colorado, and they said that approximately 70% of former Muslim believers had some kind of spiritual vision or dream which led them to the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Now, how has your family handled this news?
Well, it hasn't been easy. They didn't kick me out of the family, but given that Islamic cultures are generally very, very tightly knit, especially around the eldest son in the family, which I am, it has been quite a bit of a struggle just to have the same kind of family unity that we had before. But, of course, none of them have been too thrilled with my decision.
But I do understand, though, that it is quite common, unfortunately, that when someone converts from Islam to Christianity, their own family can make death threats to them. Would you agree with
that?
Yeah,
it happens a lot more in the Middle East, especially among people of certain sects of Islam. Our sect was more peaceful than most of those. But it is fairly common.
Okay. Well, it looks like we already have someone who's been wanting to call in, so let's see who this is. Okay. Carlo, are you on the air? Hello? Okay, doesn't look like that was anything, so we'll get back to our talk. What sect of Islam were you from?
We're from a sect called the Ahmadis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, since this is a good chance to look at something else, we're often told by Muslims that Christians, they have all these divisions between them and such, like, you know, the old myth about 30,000 denominations, but Islam itself is pretty divided, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. From the very beginning, you've had issues which have led to schisms. The largest and most well-known is the Sunni and Shia schism, which traces all the way back to the very moment Muhammad died. So you have that, but you also have many, many orders within the various sects of Islam. You have larger schools of thought within Islam. I mean, Islam is a very diverse faith.
Okay. Well, it looks like that call was trying to call in again. We'll give him one more chance. Let's see what happens. You're on the air with Nabil Qureshi. Hello?
Yes, hello?
Yes.
I'm just listening right now.
Okay. All right. Well, okay, then we'll get back to Nabil here. So, Nabil, we've had a lot of news here about the Boston bomber and such, so a lot of people are wondering about Islam now. Let's start at the very beginning then. What essentially is Islam?
Well, Islam is an entire worldview, so it encompasses both someone's religious practices as well as often someone's state loyalties. Many centuries, Islam was part of the state. A lot of the Sharia, or the Islamic law, tells people how to run a society, in addition to how to live a normal daily devotion and spiritual life. So Islam is, I would say, military as well as socio-political and religious system.
Mm-hmm. So what are the basic beliefs and such with Islam? Can you tell us Islam in a nutshell?
Yeah, Islam in a nutshell, in order to be a Muslim from the very beginning, you had to proclaim two things. You had to proclaim that Allah is God and He is the only God, and then you have to proclaim that Muhammad is a messenger of God.
Mm-hmm.
By proclaiming this, you would be a Muslim. Now, there were additional practices and beliefs. There are five pillars in Islam, which many people are somewhat familiar with, such as people going on pilgrimage to Mecca, people praying the five daily prayers, people fasting during Ramadan, and the like. So there are some required practices. And there's some required beliefs, for example, beliefs in the afterlife, belief in God using prophets to send His message to this world, belief in scriptures being sent into this world. So these are the kinds of required beliefs and practices. But essentially, as long as you are following Muhammad and you proclaim the one true God to be Allah, then you're a Muslim.
Now, we've seen a lot about with terrorists and such. We get a lot of history about Islam being a violent faith. Now, is that an aberration of Islam, or has Islam always been a somewhat violent faith?
Well, it depends really on the definition of Islam, and I think the traditional definition of Islam, the historical definition that most people are using when they say Islam, is the system that Muhammad left when he died in the 7th century. And that was very much built around some violent occurrences. From the beginning, you had, as soon as Muslims had their own city, which was Medina, They began launching raids on Meccan caravans. And now the defense for that action is that the Meccans were the ones who initially persecuted the Muslims. But regardless, you had violence. That's the very, very close to the inception of Islam. And then from then on out, it never stopped. It just continued and continued. When Muhammad died, his successors continued in wars. And all the way up until the 20th century, when some people would say the last official Islamic empire, the Ottoman Empire, collapsed. All the way up until then, you had various statements issuing jihad. Now, that said, you have Muslims who practice Islam very peacefully. They don't practice these violent teachings, but that's more of what they're doing. It's not kind of the state practice of Islam that was
established at its inception.
Now, to be clear, honestly, when I heard the news first off of Boston Bomber, my immediate thought was Muslim terrorism. And it's in our country, it's hard to avoid that. But to be fair, there are, like you said, several Muslims who would go against an action like that, condemn an action like that, and most of them are just peaceful people who are just going about living their lives. Would you say that's accurate?
I would say that's accurate. I would say the vast majority of Muslims are just like everyone else. They just want to have a good life. They want to raise a family. They want to, you know, give something to posterity. I think that's an accurate description of the vast majority of Muslims, at least in the West.
Okay. It might be different if we went across the pond, right?
If we went across the pond, I think there would be slightly more eschatological overtones as far as the domination of Islam, people wanting to establish Islam all around the world. I think you have, I mean, ideology has a foothold amongst a lot of people in the Middle East. But all the same, I would still say you have a majority of people who just want to live peacefully.
Yeah. Okay, well, I wanted to get back to you before we kept talking about the violent history and such. You said this happened with Muhammad. So most people have a basic idea about who Muhammad was. Can you give us your take on Muhammad?
Well, this is a very interesting question. I will give you the traditional take and then kind of the more scholastic, modern take.
Mm-hmm.
But the traditional take on Muhammad is that he was a man who was born at the end of the 6th century. At the age of 40, he claimed to be a prophet of God, at which point he started proclaiming monotheism. He started proclaiming welfare for widows and orphans, basically good messages. But the polytheist society of Mecca wouldn't have any of it, and so they kicked him out, after which point Muhammad started engaging in some wars against the Meccans until a matter of 10 years later. He is now in control of all of the Arabian Peninsula, at which point he dies. So that's Muhammad in a nutshell. Now, the modern scholastic view is that all the records we have of Muhammad's life come so many years after his death, and we're talking any substantial records are coming about 200 years after his death or more. Plus, you have so many holes, so many lacunae in the evidential record. In other words, when Muslims were fighting these wars, initially, no one was calling them Muslims. No one made any reference to Muhammad. The Shahada was different. So you have some holes in the records for the evidence that people aren't actually sure if the historical Muhammad comes in line with the Muhammad of faith.
Hmm. And now that you're a Christian, how would you contrast that? Because some people are, I'm sure, listening, who are atheists especially, are saying, well, isn't the same true with historical Jesus?
No, you have a huge difference between the historical Muhammad and the historical Jesus. Now, if we're going to look at Jesus' life, you have a whole gospel, the Gospel of Mark, which scholars would say is written no later than 70 A.D., and many other scholars would say is much earlier than that. But you know, at the latest, you have the first gospel written within 40 years of Jesus' life. Even before that, you have multiple epistles written by Paul. Skeptical scholars in the New Testament field will say 7 epistles that we have written by Paul. Some of them have very clear indications of what the historical Jesus said or did. For example, 1 Corinthians. So you have a lot of records of Jesus' life that are very, very close to his life, within his lifetime. You even have statements of faith like the Carmen Christi found in Philippians 2 or the Creed found in 1 Corinthians 15, which may have been within just a few years of Jesus' death on the cross, which for historical purposes is like a newsflash. You compare that with Muhammad. Now, Muhammad, you have the Quran. You have Qurans that come within about 100 years after Muhammad. But the Quran doesn't really talk about Muhammad. In fact, there's only 4 times in the Quran that Muhammad is named. When it comes to actual records of Muhammad's life, the first record we have is called Sirat Rasulullah ibn Ishaq. It comes 150 years after Muhammad dies. And we only have that through a recension by another man named Ibn Hisham. who said that Ibn Ishaq had a lot of errors in it, and so he had to edit it. And so the very first biography we have is 150 years maintained through someone else who admits there were a bunch of errors in it. And then the hadith, which the Muslims actually consider accurate for the most part, those start coming 200, 250 years after Muhammad's death. So it's a very, very different story between Muhammad and Jesus.
Now, you talked about the Quran, and when you talk about writings that were passed down with many errors, we are regularly told by Muslims about how well established the Quran is, how well it has been handed down. But it's my understanding that in the history of Islam, there is a lot of confusion about what's been in the Quran, that it was decided by one of their leaders, large and all the conflicting copies were burned. We've even found some conflicting copies in Yemen recently. So on pretty much all that stuff about the accuracy of a Quran, at least from a textual perspective, what's your opinion?
Well, I think the overwhelming evidence is that the Quran wasn't intended to be a written book by Muhammad. Muhammad envisioned the Quran to be a oral book. The way it was dictated, the way his scribes made notes of what the Quran was, they didn't actually write the whole thing out. The way he considered the borders to be fluid, for example, he would recite a certain verse to people, and people would recite it in different ways, and he'd say, oh, you're both fine, it doesn't matter, those little differences don't matter. The way he said that portions of the Quran could be abrogated, he would say, remember that portion I recited to you a year ago, don't recite that anymore, it's no longer part of the Quran. All of this points singly towards an oral view of a text, not a written view. When Muhammad dies, you have people who start losing portions of the Quran. His successor, Abu Bakr, sends a bunch of people who know the Quran very well into war, because as soon as Muhammad died, 10 different tribes tried to leave Islam. They didn't want to be Muslims now that Muhammad was dead. Abu Bakr sends some of the most well-learned Quran folk into these wars, and they start dying, so he's now worried that the Quran's going to be lost. But then they start writing it down. When they start writing it down, they start realizing they have a whole lot of discrepancies. Even the teachers that Muhammad picked, the top two teachers that we know of who are still commenting on the Quran at this point, are Abdullah ibn Mas'ud and Ubay ibn Ka'b. The two of them start arguing over what should be in the Quran. Today's version of the Quran has 114 chapters.
Mm-hmm.
The man that Muhammad picked as the number one teacher of the Quran says, no, it should only have 111 chapters. One of the other teachers that Muhammad picked says, no, it should have 116 chapters. So you've got these kinds of disagreements, not among regular people, but among the very people Muhammad picked to teach the Quran. It wasn't until the Quran was written down in Uthman's time, Uthman was the third successor after Muhammad, that you have a standardized Quran. And even then, this book was the first book ever written in Arabic. No one had ever written an Arabic book before, and so they didn't actually have the script precisely codified enough to where it would no longer be changed. So after Uthman's time, you have many people reciting it differently still. 323 years after Muhammad's death, I'm sorry, 323 years after the Hijrah, you have a man who comes, his name's Ibn Mujahid. He tries to cut down the way the Quran is recited amongst many people. And he cuts it down, and then again in 1924, you have the official Quran printed, and finally, the vast majority of the Muslim world is reading the Quran in one way, and that starts in 1924.
A lot of this information is really fascinating. Before we go to our first break, can you tell us some scholarly sources some people can go to if they're wanting to read more about this?
Yeah, so actually, if Muslims don't believe what I say, and usually they don't, Sahih Bukhari, which is the most trustworthy book of hadith, according to Sunni Muslims. Book 61 in Sahih Bukhari is all about the compilation of the Quran, and a lot of what I just said is found right there. If you want to have a Western scholar who summarizes this very well, his name is Keith Small, and he wrote a book called Textual Criticism and Quran Manuscripts. It's a very well-received book, and it just came out a couple years ago, so those would be good places to start.
Okay, we are on the air with Nabil Qureshi. Our number is 714-242-7900. 5180 if you want to call in, and we will be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
This is Mike Lacona. Nick Peters is my son-in-law, and I'm excited to announce his new podcast in which Nick will discuss and have guests on topics related to Christian apologetics and dealing with disabilities. Nick has already interviewed apologetic stars such as Greg Kokel and Rob Bowman, and I know of other stars he's in the process of inviting. So be sure to check out Nick's new podcast.
And we are back to the Deeper Waters podcast. I am Nick Peters. My number is 714-242-5180. I thought the Mike Lacona promo was apropos to play here because Mike is actually the person I know you through Nabeer, and if I remember correctly, he's got a book out, Paul Meets Muhammad, where it's a discussion between Paul and Muhammad about Jesus, and you actually had a hand in helping him with that book some, didn't you?
Yeah, I was actually a Muslim at the time that Mike wrote it, and I was still looking into the arguments for Islamic Christianity, and I happened to know Mike because he was in my neighborhood, and we had had some discussions on the historical Jesus, so he asked me to read through it and see what I thought. And I thought Mike handled it quite well. Muslims are generally very opposed to any depictions of Muhammad, even written ones, that don't correspond to the historical record. But Mike did a good job circumventing that by, well, I won't give it away.
Yeah.
He did a good job being sensitive to Muslim sensibilities. Yes. And I thought it was a well-written book.
It's a very fascinating read, and something else about more so, and this kind of gets into a topic I'd like to discuss a bit too. He recently had a Muslim, Tak El Nimir, I apologize if I've butchered the name terribly, but he posted an article on Mike's page, and I've noticed something, and I try to be nice about this, but a lot of times in the video, when I read Muslim arguments, they are just incredibly weak, incredibly bad arguments. I mean, am I missing something, or I really don't think I am, because this is what I hear from several Christians who study these kinds of things.
It's a paradigm difference. Now, Muslims are often coming from an authoritarian paradigm, whereas Westerners are not. Westerners are often coming from a critical thinking paradigm. So they want to see, generally Muslims want to see evidence that comes from lines of authorities that they recognize. And so if they're using arguments of their own, or if they're using arguments that aren't really espoused by scholars or historical commentators, then it doesn't necessarily work for them. And the arguments you share with them as a Christian, they'll often not be able to register those because you don't fall within their line of authority. So it's a totally different paradigm from how they're normally thinking.
If that's the case, what do we do about people out there who are Christians who want to witness to their Muslim friends? How does a Christian do that then?
Well, I think the most important thing to do for a Christian would be to, in a sense, become an authority in that person's life. By sharing the love of Christ, by being an active member of their life, by earning the right to speak into their lives. At that point, the arguments that they share will be far more powerful.
Now, if we went back to look at Muhammad with this as well, Muhammad, it said that he might have had some understanding of Christian doctrine, but it's an incredibly bad understanding, which unfortunately I see happening a lot with Muslims today, that even in the Quran, Muhammad gets the doctrine of the Trinity wrong. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. In chapter 5, verse 116 of the Quran, you have Muhammad. The Quran seems to imply that the Trinity is Mary, Jesus, and the Father.
And it's my understanding that some scholars believe Muhammad probably came in contact with Nestorian Christians instead.
Yeah, that's probably true, especially because many of the exiled heretics or people who were not believing Orthodox Christian teachings, they often went down into the Arabian area, so it's quite possible what Muhammad knew to be Christians were actually heretical Christians.
Okay. Now, I know about Nestorianism, but it could be a lot of my listeners aren't very clear about it, and you and I both know what we're talking about, but let's make it clear. What are we talking about for our listeners?
Well, I actually think that Nestorianism is just one of the few of the belief systems that were there. So I'll let you comment specifically on Nestorianism, but the ones who came in contact with Muhammad, the Christians who were there, they were Gnostic Christians who often had beliefs in certain Gnostic Gospels, and those beliefs found their way into the Quran. For example, you have things from the Arabic infancy gospel, which is a Gnostic gospel, which is found in the Quran, that Jesus started speaking at the moment he was born. This was something that came from Gnostic gospel. In addition, you have something from the Gnostic gospel of Thomas, which is also found in the Quran, specifically that Jesus was able to give life to clay birds. So it's not just Nestorianism, but many different Gnostic beliefs rolled into one are found in Muhammad's understanding of Christians.
Yeah, and he also had this understanding that Jesus wasn't crucified. And I understand the Quran doesn't explicitly say that, but this is one of the biggest things of Muslims is they consistently argue that Jesus was not crucified.
Well, and that's exactly what chapter 4, verse 157 of the Quran says. Jesus was not killed, nor was he crucified.
And this is kind of one of the strongest Achilles heels of Islam, isn't it?
I would think so. If a Muslim is coming from an evidential standpoint, in other words, they're not saying, oh, I just believe by faith, but they're saying this faith has strong evidence behind it. If they come from that standpoint, I would just point to the historical Jesus, and I would say we have overwhelming evidence that Jesus did die on the cross. You have certain scholars who are not Christians by any means who say that this is one of the most powerful facts of history, that Jesus died by crucifixion. How can you overturn the weight of this historical evidence in order to believe what the Quran says if you consider the Quran to be historically founded?
Now, with what we were talking about also of Nestorianism, it's very difficult to really explain, but it's kind of like there's two different sides in Christ, the human and divine side, and they interact as such. It's one of those difficult areas because we don't have a lot of the writings from him and such, and I'm sure you know as well as I do that people's teachings can be misunderstood very easily.
Especially since many of the teachings we have from some of the Gnostics, we actually have them from refutations by Orthodox Christians. Mm-hmm. They weren't necessarily known to be the most fair-minded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyway, to get back to the Quran and crucifixion, I mean, for instance, even a liberal scholar as liberal as John Dominic Crossan will say, if there is one fact about Jesus that we can be sure of, it's that Jesus Christ was crucified. Now, this, I suppose, gets to be a authority thing, that the Muslim looks at the claims and says, the claims are all wrong because we have it on the authority of Allah himself that Jesus wasn't crucified. Is that how it works?
Often they won't necessarily turn to Allah himself, but what they will say is that if the Quran says it and evidence doesn't point to it, then there's something wrong with the evidence. And so that's how they'll couch it. They won't necessarily defer to the authority of Allah.
Now, also, if we went back to the Trinity, you know, to the Muslims, Trinity, saying that you believe in the Trinity, it's one of the highest forms of blasphemy, isn't it?
Yeah. Same section of the Quran, chapter 5, if you read verse 72, it actually defines shirk. Shirk is the unforgivable sin in Islam. And it actually says that if you believe the Son of Mary, Jesus, is God, then you will have a one-way ticket to hell. You're committing shirk. That will be your abode forever.
Okay. We've had Rob Bowman come on here to discuss the Trinity. if we were talking with a Muslim and the topic of the Trinity came up, how would you recommend we handle it?
Well, I think the very first thing every Christian should be able to do who's a Trinitarian, or at least believes Trinity to be an important doctrine, is to define it, to be able to define what the Trinity is. And most people can't do that. So we need to know that the doctrine of the Trinity is that there is one being, God, who exists in three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit, and be able to define that. So actually yesterday I had a conversation with a Moroccan Muslim who had a very poor understanding of the Trinity. He was thinking more in terms of modalism, where the Trinity is basically God putting on, you know, different roles at different times. I find that most Muslims do think that, that the Trinity is a kind of modalism. But to be able to say, no, there are three co-eternal persons within the Godhead, to be able to define that and to show biblical references for it, I think that's very important.
That's a sad thing also is, unfortunately, most Christians would probably also give that impression, which doesn't really help us if we're Muslims, because if more Christians go out and give a false view of Muslims, that just re-emphasizes to the Muslim that, yeah, this is what Christians believe.
Yeah, exactly.
And then when we come to the incarnation, see, I remember reading an article once with James White talking about giving a talk and how these Muslims came up and they started asking him, and the first question that they pretty much got to, well, he said he was stunned by, it was the first one I was expecting to see because I'd seen it happened several times, is they have a view of God that's so supreme and holy, which is good, but they take it that, and then they say that, well, then, anything that we consider that we don't like, God couldn't do that, so the incarnation couldn't be true. In other words, when they come to the incarnation, the question I was asked was, well, your God then went to the bathroom, and that's unholy, so how could he be God?
Right.
So, I mean, it is that kind of thinking that, in some ways, that thinking is good, that we do need to recognize God as good and holy. But this is the kind of thinking that's common with Muslims. So how should we handle objections like that?
It's a very good question. It's a very difficult one to do, especially for Muslims who just simply cannot get the fact that God can enter into this world if he needs to. The main point that I tend to make is that Christians view God as a father. He's not just a tyrant. He's not just a king who lords rules over you. Our God, yes, he is a king, but he's a fatherly king. And what that means is, for example, if a father who's a king happens to be walking along and sees his son drowning in a pool of mud, this king is... sure, majestic. He's revered by everyone. But don't you think if he's a loving father, he would throw off his robes and dive into that pool of mud in order to save his son? That a king would not do that. He would just stand idly by. Would mean he's not loving. He cares about his majesty more than he loves his child. But that's not the Christian God. The Christian God doesn't consider equality with God a thing to be grasped. He's willing to lower himself. And that's exactly what God does. So yes, it is dirty. Yes, it is. It is not becoming of God's majesty, but that's because he cares about us that much.
Now, you talked about that God's not distant in Christianity. He's not a tyrant who's off living out there. But in Islam, I understand Allah is very distant, that they don't want anything to do with the idea of the imminence of God, and Allah becomes totally transcendent.
Yes, that's correct. It's difficult for Muslims to grasp the idea of incarnation specifically because they consider Allah to be so unknowable that there's no way God would come into this world. Now, of course, there's a little problem with that, which is in the Quran, you have a verse where Moses is talking to the burning bush, and it actually says that God was in that bush. So it gives them a little theological challenge, but generally that doesn't enter into their theology.
Do you know right off what verse that would be for people who have their Qurans with them?
You know, I don't know it offhand. I think it's in chapter 18, but I don't know it offhand.
Mm-hmm. It's also my understanding, then, that they make Allah so distant and transcendent that if they were to use one attribute of his that would be supreme, it would be his will.
Yes, and that's actually one of the six articles of faith I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. The last of the six is God's divine decree. Mm-hmm. And essentially, it's whatever Allah wants goes.
Mm-hmm.
Really doesn't matter if you lived your life holy, your entire life, you've never committed a sin. If God wanted to throw you into hell, he could. And vice versa. If you've only ever done sin after sin after sin, if God wants to throw you into heaven, he can. So God's will is totally arbitrary, and that's all right because he's God, according to Islam.
And this also means that whenever any natural disaster or anything whatsoever happens, it's always because Allah has willed it.
Yes. Yes, I remember hearing that a lot when I was a kid growing up. People would just say it's the will of Allah.
In fact, I understand this has even led to the lack of scientific investigation and such in the Muslim community, because they can just say, whatever happens, it happens because Allah wills it, and that's all we need to know.
I would say in certain sectors of Islamic society that has been the case, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read the book The Closing of a Muslim Mind by Robert Riley, and he says that unfortunately that many Islamic civilizations, they've never really had a strong, thriving intellectual culture.
That's true, and in part that has to do with illiteracy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just never really been emphasized in Islamic cultures to become literate on a wide-scale level. Now, there are certain hadiths that would point to education being a good thing, but as far as the practical application in society, even today you have huge numbers of illiteracy. For example, in Egypt, 50% of women are illiterate, and Egypt is one of the more advanced Islamic nations in the world.
Is that because of some doctrine of Islam or a political reason? Why is that the case?
Well, it's interesting you should ask. Arabic actually has multiple forms, and the written form of Arabic, which is called Fusha, it is not actually spoken by anyone. It's only spoken in scholastic lectures in schools and on news reports.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, everyone speaks colloquial Arabic. So in order to become literate, most Muslims have to essentially learn another language.
Mm-hmm. Now, something else we should talk about. You talk about before we go out, let's just talk about knowing another language, that most Muslims then also, even if they want to, they don't have the means to do this, right?
How do you mean?
They don't have the means to learn another language.
So, you mean in general across the Muslim world?
Yeah.
Yeah, many Muslims around the Islamic world, in order to become educated, they would have to first be able to pay for school, because quite often the public school is not as efficient in teaching things, or it might not even exist. The infrastructure might not even exist for public schools. And then at that point, they have to learn this language, Fusha, in order to be able to read Arabic. And once they do that, then they're able to move on to another language if they're going to learn one. And it's just a lot of work, and it's very difficult for people to even get off the ground in a lot of Arabic societies.
Anyway, I'm thinking we got someone who's wanting to talk to you for something. Let's see if it's Carlo wants to talk this time.
Sure.
Carlo, you're on the air from Nabil Qureshi.
How you doing? I want to ask a question. I noticed that the gentleman said that Allah seems somewhat distant. So my question will be, how would he explain the verse in Surah 50, Ayah 16, that says, it was we who created man, and we know what darkness adjusts his souls make to him. For we are nearer to him than jugular vein. So I would like to know, how would he explain that in what he was saying, that Allah in Islam is far distant from Muslims?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's actually one of the more common ones. I'm glad you brought up the context of the verse, because it's not saying that God is knowable. That's not at all what it's saying. If you read the context of the verse, it's actually saying that if you challenge Allah, or if you perform in a sinful manner, then you should remember that Allah is the one who made you. He's closer to you than your jugular vein. In other words, he can kill you if he wants to. That's the actual interpretation of the verse. That's a classical interpretation of the verse. It's never been meant to be a reassuring verse of, you know, this should help you know that God loves you, he's close to you, or that you can know God personally. That's never been the interpretation of this verse until maybe modern times, but traditionally speaking, it's been one of warning that do not sin, otherwise God can kill you. He's closer to you than your jugular vein.
Okay, so my question, you said it's not been, you're taking it from the standpoint of what the people, what they normally have interpreted to be. Not that they...
No, I'm saying it's the context of the verse itself. It's pretty clear. It's not one about you personally knowing God. It's about God being able to punish you because he has access to your jugular vein.
If I can step in here for a little bit, Jim, we need to take a quick break. When we get back, we can answer some more questions. Is that all right?
Sounds good?
Yes.
Okay. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We will be right back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. At www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at cyiworldwide.com.
And we are back discussing with Nabil Qureshi until the top of the hour here. And looks like we've got someone who's been asking some questions. So, sir, if you can ask your question again to Nabil here where you left off, that'd be great.
Right. My question I went to Nabil was when he said that Allah is not close at all to the Muslims in relation to them being able to understand who he is and what he represents. And when I brought out the verse in Surah 50, Ayah 16, when the verse said that Allah is nearer to him than his jugular vein, Nabil has said that the understanding of it would have been that Allah can take your life. Now, my issue with that is that that's not what the verse is saying, that Allah is close to you when he takes your life. Actually, Allah tells us when the angels come to take the life. So in this relation, when Allah is directly saying that he is closer to you than your jugular vein, Nabir was saying that it has to do with death. And the verse in the Quran speaks about when the angels come to take your life. So I was wondering if he was open for the possibility that no matter if the people, the common thought was this had to do with death, could it be possible that it also pertains to Allah just in general being closer to you than your jugular vein?
Yeah, I think, I see what you're saying, but I would just have to say, what is the context of the passage? Now, I'll read it for everyone since we're focusing on it. I'll read it for everyone so that they can grasp the context. It says, I'm going to start with, this is chapter 50 of the Quran, by the way. I'm going to start with verse 15. Were we then weary with the first creation, that they should be in confused doubt about a new creation? It was we who created man, and we know what dark suggestions his soul makes to him, for we are nearer to him than his jugular vein. Behold, two guardian angels appointed to learn his doings, learn and note them, one sitting on the right and one on the left. Not a word does he utter, but there is a sentinel by him ready to note it. And the stupor of death will bring truth. This was the thing which thou was trying to escape. So, in other words, this passage is clearly not at all about man knowing God. Not at all. If anything, it's about God being able to know what man's doing. He's saying he's put two angels, one on his right shoulder, one on his left shoulder, in order to record everything man does. It's him saying, I know man, I created man, I know what dark suggestions are in his soul. That's why we are nearer to him than his jugular vein. In other words, there's nothing about this passage that intimates man can know God. If anything, it's quite the opposite. God can know man. And that's what this section's about. So anyone's free to draw any wild interpretations that they want. But if we're going to be responsible to the text in its context, this is not at all talking about man knowing God. The other way around.
Okay, well, I guess we're going to leave it back with that point then. So, let's get back then to maybe Warren. I think it's very important what you did there is that we often accuse Muslims and others of taking the Bible out of context. And a lot of times they do that. We want to make sure we're not doing the exact same thing as the Quran.
That's true. Now, the Quran is a different book entirely. We have to remember that the Quran was written in a totally different fashion. So when we quote the Bible, let's say, for example, we're quoting the Gospel of John. John wrote from John 1 to the end. It's one book. It was published together as a book. The Quran is not that. The Quran is little packets of verses that Muhammad revealed. And at the end, after he died, they're all compiled in a book. To actually quote things out of context is somewhat more common for Muslims because the verses often weren't in context to begin with, if that makes any sense. But all that said, we should still be responsible for the context as best we can. And if there is clearly a logical pattern in the context, as there is here in this section of the Quran, then we should be responsible to it and do our best to be good exegetes.
Okay, but it looks like caller has decided to call back in, so let's see what happens this time. You're on the air of Nabil Qureshi.
Hello?
You're on the air.
Yes, hello?
Yeah, do you have a question for Nabil?
All right. Now, what I wanted to do, I got knocked offline, and so I'm just calling back. I think I had to press 1 in order to chime in. But I didn't press 1. I just wanted to get back online first.
Okay.
So I'm just listening because we can go back and forth with that particular area. I mean, we wanted to pull out the verses that had to do with how close Allah is to the believers, and that would take a while. And I don't believe in taking the time away from the air. So he doesn't agree with the way that I understand it. As far as the context, one verse ahead of that next verse in 16, that's not the context of it. The context of it will be the whole surah, and that will require time. So this is how I understand it, but I understand what Anabir said, so I will just continue to listen.
Okay. In that case, let's suppose this guy wants to get in touch with you some after you go off the air, and let's suppose the rest of my listeners want to get some material. Before we ask any more questions, how can anyone get in touch with you if they want to hear more or talk more about what you said on the show today?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm in the middle of transitioning from one ministry to another, so it's going to be kind of hard to get in touch with me, but if you just do a Google search for my name, Nabil Qureshi, N-A-B-E-E-L, and last name is Qureshi, you'll be able to come to my website, and you'll be able to see some videos and whatnot that I've put online. So lots of resources are available.
Okay. Well, since we've had a Boston bomber recently, let's have some talks about how is it that a Christian is supposed to respond to the idea of Muslim terrorism and such? What do Christians need to understand about the terrorist problem today?
Well, I think the first thing that Christians need to remember is that Christ said that no one who doesn't pick up a cross and follow him is worthy of following him. So you can't expect to have a peaceful Christian life where you're safe and sound. That's not what Christ called us to. To be ready to grapple with death, to be ready to understand that our deaths are imminent and that Christ has conquered those deaths already. That's part of what the Christian faith entails. So whenever I see a Christian respond in fear to Islamic terrorism or terrorism of any sort, That to me tells me that there's something missing from the foundation of their Christian faith, that they're afraid of anything. According to 2 Timothy chapter 1, we're not given a spirit of fear, but a spirit of power. And we need to remember that. That said, how do we respond specifically to Muslims or to these terrorist attacks? See, the first thing we should do is we should always, always, always remember that there is no human being in this world who is the enemy to a Christian. Every Christian has to truly love everyone out there. That's just part of what it means to have Christian to be a Christian, is to be willing to love your enemies, to pray for those who persecute you, to, if someone's trying to steal your cloak, give them your tunic. If they're trying to make you walk 1 mile, go two. That's what it means to be a Christian. So no hatred allowed here. when it comes to someone who's trying to kill you, you need to be able to turn around and pray for them. And that's, I think, the appropriate Christian response is, number one, to be in prayer. And number two, really let Christ perfuse your heart so that you can share the gospel with people so that these kinds of things don't happen. The older brother in this Boston Marathon bombing, he actually tweeted shortly before everything happened, he tweeted that he didn't understand any Americans because he didn't have any American friends. I can almost guarantee you, if Christians had met him and shared the love of Christ with him, he would have not been able to tweet that, for one. He would know some Christians, he would know some Americans, and number two, he might not have been so willing to kill the unknown people around him. And I'm not blaming Christians in this. I'm just saying that the gospel has the power to transform, and that's been our tool that we've been given. So that's one thing. But the other response would be to understand what's going on. This is not just individuals who are acting up out of anger. This is actually the outcropping of a system that has very much espoused fear, inciting fear in people from the very beginning. Muhammad is actually recorded as having said that, "I have been granted success through terrorism." So this is not, in our moment of love towards our enemy, we can't give up on truth. The truth of the matter is, from its beginning, Islam has given a very strong foundation to those who might wish to use it for violent means, and we need to understand that too.
Anyway, it looks like we've got another caller who's wanting to call in. You're pretty popular today, so let's see what else has been said. Caller, you're on the air of Nabil Qureshi.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Hey, Christ is risen. Nabil, I have a question about relativism within Islam. And it seems to me, and I don't know a whole lot about Islam, is that by my interactions and talking with them, it seems that when it comes to interpreting the Quran, that there's no one straight answer with them. And plus you have the differences of Sunni and Shia and all the other apex groups that are out there. And so it seems to me that Islam, even though it claims absolute truth, has a type of relativism within its own system. Is that a good observance, or am I off here?
No, I think that's a very astute observation. The Quran itself is interpreted in so many different ways by different Muslims, usually towards their ends or their means. It's because, well, for one, very few Muslims actually think that the Quran is complete, that insofar as it has all the theology a Muslim needs. Pretty much every Muslim believes that the Quran needs to be supplemented by hadith. And then they all disagree on which hadith are accurate and which are not. So in order to supplement their exegesis, they'll use a hadith. And the hadith they all have differently, and so they'll end up with different interpretations of the Quran. So it's a very astute observation. Ultimately, I think what happens in a very practical sense, what happens is people have an interpretation of Islam, and when they read the Quran, they interpret it to fit their interpretation. That's what I've seen happen quite a bit. And the Quran is much more pliable in that sense, much more able to do that than the Bible is.
Yeah, it used to be like, you talked about the Achilles heel of historical Jesus, and this seems to be the other Achilles heel to me, anyway.
Yeah, in an objective sense, yes, but it gives them a lot of leeway to respond to criticisms, because if the Quran doesn't mean anything explicitly per se, it depends on your interpretations, then they can easily find ways out of certain things that they might find problematic.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, well, that's all I wanted to ask, and just be in prayer for all the Christians that are in Syria and in Egypt in these difficult and hard
times. Absolutely.
God bless you guys.
Lord bless you, brother.
Thank you. Thank you, caller. Okay, if we go back to the question about how Christians should respond, you have said we should show grace, and I agree, but I think politically, as a nation, one of the other mistakes we can make, and if I'm wrong with this, you can tell me, is that we can show weakness as well. But when we say we want to be tolerant, for instance, when we want to show understanding and such, when we don't want to say anything negative about Islam, that the Muslim community sees that as weakness, and it incites them to do further violence to us.
Yeah, I actually saw a great quotation online the other day. Elise Strobel tweeted it. It was, "Love without truth is too soft, but truth without love is too hard."
Mm-hmm.
You need to have both. You need to have both love and truth. And so in this case, if there is a violent threat to our nation, we need to grapple with that, and we need to recognize it for what it is. And in the media, you see a lot of people just kind of discrediting the possibility that Islam might have anything to do with these terrorist attacks. That's silly. That's endangering the whole nation. You need to understand what is giving rise to these terrorist attacks, and it is a theology, but not just a theology. It's a theology combined with political agendas, etc. But the theology is a large part of it. That needs to be understood. So when I say have grace and share the gospel, I'm talking about on a personal level, one-on-one with people, where we need to show them love. As far as national policy is concerned, I'm no expert in national policy, but we need to definitely not try to pull the curtain over our own eyes.
Okay. Would it be accurate if we could say Muslims are not our enemy, but the system of Islam is?
Oh, I think that's a legitimate statement. I think Islam has trapped a lot of people and it's trapped a lot of women. It's trapped a lot of people in slavery. I mean, the system of Islam, as Christians, we're free to dislike Islam, but we're not free to dislike Muslims.
Okay. Now, we've only got about 2.5 more minutes with you, so one thing we should probably end on is, I think I've been told before that one of the ways to reach Muslims also is that Muslims have no real idea of salvation as a certainty, that the concept of grace to them is foreign. It doesn't really make sense. So, for a couple minutes left, what would you say about that?
Well, I would say that's a simplification. I think that you do have a concept of grace in Islam, but it is different. For example, Allah can forget people's sins if He wants, and so in so doing, increase their good deeds. It's still a works-based soteriology, but there is the grace there of Allah choosing to forget your sins or choosing to overlook them. There is some of that. Now, that said, it's not something that Allah has then told Muslims to emulate. He hasn't told them to go and espouse grace. If you read chapter 60, verse 1 of the Quran, Allah says, "You want to love your enemies, but I'm telling you not to love them because they're my enemies too." So He actually stops people from loving one another. That's the total opposite of the Christian faith, which says love your enemies even to the point of death, because that's what God did when we were still His enemy. So in that sense, the grace is very different. You also have a peculiar mixing of traditional Islam with Western values that's happening in my generation, especially with children of Muslim immigrants. They're mixing a lot of this stuff together. So a lot of them will say that they are secure in their salvation, but that's this new Islam that's coming up in the 21st century. It's not the traditional Islam. So we have to bear in mind that there are differences within the Islamic worldview, especially as it's becoming modernized. But generally speaking, you're absolutely right. Grace has a very different connotation in Islam versus Christianity, and it's not something they're expected to emulate.
Okay, one more question before we let you go here. Suppose you've got a Muslim who's listening in here. What is your final word to a Muslim listening?
My final word would be to pursue God. There's so much in Islam that gets you to pursue the system of Islam. You know, start praying five times a day, start fasting and do this and that. And Muslims become devoted to the system of Islam. And often they leave out what God might be, what he might want, who he might tell us to be. There's often no relationship there between a person and God in Islam. And once you start pursuing God, you might begin to question, wait a minute, how do I know Muhammad is actually the messenger of God? How do I actually know the Quran is the word of God? And in that sense, you'll come to have a faith. I mean, if you begin to answer those questions, maybe that'll make you a good Muslim. But start looking into those questions, and it's my guess, because it's what happened to me, that when you start looking into the reasons why you're a Muslim, they start falling short when you start focusing on God and not the religion itself.
Yeah, so much more I would have liked to have discussed, but time's an limitation. But hopefully we'll have you back here in again sometime, Nabir. Thank you for giving us some of your time today.
Lord bless you, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
You too. And that has been Nabir Qureshi, but I'm still here for another hour, and we're just going to be talking about various matters and such here. But we will be right back after this break.
Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grock as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told. Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You could send a gift or love offering through our website at CYIWorldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And we are back to the Deeper Waters podcast. I'm your host, Nick Peters. If you want to ask a question, number is 714-242-5180. I want to thank Nabir for taking the time to be with us. And we talked some about Islam. I'm not really planning on talking about that during this next hour because, frankly, I'm not an expert on Islam. That's why I sometimes have a lot of these great guests on here, because you can have people who are experts in things you're not. But Nabil did say something towards the end there that I thought was really great. He talked about how that some Muslims can get caught up in going through all these motions and such, that they don't really take the time to consider who the God is that they are serving. And as he said that, my thinking was, a lot of Christians, we're doing that too. And I just keep having this idea coming that we Christians tend to build up our own private little subculture, and we never step outside of that box at all. I have called it the escapist mentality of Christians. And we have this idea that it's really a Gnostic idea. If you remember Gnosticism, Gnosticism was the idea that said that the material world is evil, and the true God has nothing to do with it. It's an evil God who's behind it, and Jesus came to deliver us from the material world. Now, there are several different branches in such a Gnosticism, but generally that's the idea that you would come across. And unfortunately today, a lot of Christians seem to have that same attitude, that anything to do with the material world is ipso facto evil, and God is going to do away with this wicked old world, and he's going to take us to an eternal bliss somewhere. And I honestly really don't see that in the Bible. I see God is going to do away with this system of things, and I see that God will provide us with eternal joy in his presence. But I see that's going to take place in this world that he created to be his temple, to share his glory, the world that he is going to rule over someday. Or rather, he rules over it right now, but he's going to have a complete recognized rule by everyone at that point. And so when we have this kind of escapist mentality, it really doesn't help us out. And we get caught up in our little subculture, and we refuse to ask ourselves the hard questions about our faith. And how can we expect Muslims or anyone else to ask hard questions about what they believe if we are not willing to do the exact same thing with what we believe? And you find some Christians growing up in the church, and they start having doubts. They start having these questions. They want answers. And a lot of times what can happen is the church will just shun them, cast them away, because you're rocking the boat. Okay, we all have a good thing going here. We all enjoy each other's presence. Please don't come here and be asking all these questions. They don't really help us. My friends, we need to remember the advice of Benjamin Franklin. Our critics are our friends. They show us our faults. Now, I'm not saying that there are faults within the system of Christianity itself, but Christians do have faults. And we do have areas we need to work on. And there are hard questions that we need to step back and take a good, long look at. Because you can be going up there, you can be saying your prayers, you can be doing your evangelism, but is your mind really engaging at all with what you believe? Now, I'm not telling everyone to go out there and be an intellectual. I know it's not in everyone. But you do need to be asking yourself a question. What do I really believe? How do I know it's true? What difference does it make? If you're not asking these questions, I really don't think you're going to be growing in the faith. Okay, we got someone calling in here, so let's ask a question. Caller, you're on the air. What's your question today?
No, sir. I'm just, again, I keep getting my number. It keeps getting dropped, so I'm just listening to you. I don't press one, so it just cues me in automatically for whatever reason. I didn't press one yet.
Okay, I don't know what to tell you about that. So, if anyone wants to listen to this, you can go to Blog Talk Radio and listen from your computer. But in Christians, okay. So, Christians, we have to be asking ourselves these questions. It's far better that you ask yourself these kinds of questions right now, when you can do the research and answer them, and you're not, you know, emotionally pressed at the time, than when you're out evangelizing and you meet someone who's an atheist or a Muslim or a Jew or someone like that who has this kind of question, and you don't know how to answer it then, and you're left flummoxed in a panic. And not only have you embarrassed yourself, you've embarrassed the gospel at that point. Ask yourself these questions right now. Take the time and look at the hard questions of your faith. And I'm convinced that if you do this, and if you treat the investigation fairly, you will come out of it a stronger Christian. It's what happened when I was going through my own struggles. And this is very difficult at the start. I remember that the objections in the past, they used to keep me up at night wondering about these questions, and now those objections, ones that were worrying me, they're not, I don't even blink right now, because material has been so well learned and studied. And by all means, feel free to read both sides. I was at a conversation this week, a discussion that was held at a local college for the Christian group fair, and was talking about inerrancy, which in our family is a topic we have a very strong interest in due to certain accusations that have been made towards us, accusations which I believe myself and others have handily refuted. But anyway, right, I see a problem going on here, because The idea of inerrancy, unfortunately, often leads to not asking questions. Now, that's not saying inerrancy is false. I'm not saying that at all, but saying that if you question something, you're questioning the text. And if you question the text, you're questioning the Word of God. If you're questioning the Word of God, you're saying the Word of God has errors. And that's not what really follows. The strongest inerrantist out there should be questioning the text. Whenever you're doing your Bible reading in the day, you need to be questioning the text. You need to be asking those questions of it that will make you explore it even more. Yeah, I bring this up because when we were at this meeting, and these are students who have just gone to college, and there's this girl in there, and she starts saying, we hear all this about the textual problems of a text and all these inaccuracies and such, and I have quotation marks around each of those, of course. And she says, I wonder why is it in all my years of growing up in the church, no one told me this, and I didn't find out about it, I didn't get hit with it until I was a sophomore in college. You know, around this point, I'm wanting to scream. This is the same kind of mentality that's producing so many problems. This girl, thank goodness, she's still in the faith because she could have just as easily abandoned the faith. And these students that were in there, they were asking questions. They were wanting answers. Now, yeah, I know that's not what every student in the church is doing, but several are. And we need to be able to give them real answers for the questions that they are having. If we can give them real answers, you can be sure they're going to go off and get answers from someone else. And those answers are not going to be the answers we want them to have. They're going to get the answers from a Bart Ehrman, or Richard Dawkins, or Robert Price, or John Dominic Crossan, or someone like this. They are not going to get an answer that really reflects what we would have them believe, what we think is the true answer. And this also gets to the point of fair investigation. Something we said there was that, and this has been my reading entirely, what I've noticed is that when I'm reading those who disagree with Christianity, I see very little interaction with Christian arguments. This is true even on the scholarly level. If I'm reading New Testament scholars that disagree, I don't really see much interaction with evangelical arguments. On the other hand, when I'm reading evangelicals, I see plenty of interaction with non-Christian arguments. Now, the supreme example of this would be the new atheist. If there is any group out there that's popular in the popular culture today that doesn't interact with its accusers, it would be the new atheism. The new atheism comes with this assumption that all their opponents must just be simply deluded in some sense. And they're not worth reading at all. There's no real arguments out there. I've got an article at the blog site, my blog, deeperwaters.wordpress.com, The Shoddy Research of New Atheism, where I've documented this from a number of their books with how little their bibliographies show interaction with Christian works, how little Christians are cited in the index, things like that. And yet this movement is so popular, especially on the internet, one of the greatest breeding grounds of ignorance, unfortunately. You'll find the new atheist Gregory saying that Christians believe in believing things without evidence, because that's what faith is. Faith is believing something without evidence. Unfortunately, a lot of Christians have the exact same stance. I've had a Christians tell me where they think there's no evidence whatsoever for the Bible. And I'm just shaking my head at this point. I can't really believe what I'm hearing. Well, unfortunately, in many ways, I can, because our church has been dumbed down this much. But when a Richard Dawkins or a Sam Harris says this, it's simply wrong. Faith is not believing without evidence. Faith comes from the Greek word pistis. Now, I would like these atheists out there to find me one Greek lexicon or New Testament lexicon that has a definition of that word as meaning belief without evidence. I have never seen it. Which, if they can't back this position, then that tells me they have a belief without evidence. And they've trumpeted this without doing any real research into the matter. In fact, if you read a book like Bruce Molina and Jerome Nery's book, Portraits of Paul, they point out that the word pistis actually in that day could mean to a forensic proof. The true meaning of pistis is trust and loyalty. One is to show trust to the one who has shown himself to be reliable, or one is to place trust in evidence that has shown itself to be reliable. One has faith that Jesus rose from the dead because there has been evidence put forward for that position that is reliable. Now, in historical circles, you can't really talk about proof, per se, not in the scientific sense. And a lot of the problems of what we have today is we've inherited a culture that thinks with a kind of scientism that everything has to be proven in a scientific sense. And that's not the way much of our understanding works. In history, we largely go by probability. What case is the most probable? In this case, I think the resurrection hypothesis stands up the most. The arguments I see from so many people against this all come down to, ultimately, what ifs. Where, what if this was the case? What if this was the case? What if Jesus rose from the dead, but it wasn't God who did it? What if it was a devil who did it? What if it was a demon? To which I can think of Peter Crate's response to this, where he applies it to the argument from desire. But I'm going to apply to the resurrection. That's, wait, you're going to go with a demon for a resurrection to avoid God? You want to go with a devil to avoid God? Why on earth would you do that? Now, my ultimate reasons for thinking the devil hypothesis for resurrection don't work aren't just that. It's just one point to consider. But so you read the story of Israel in the past. You see the typology going on there. You see the prophetic prophecies of the coming Messiah. And yeah, I know a lot of these aren't really prophecies in the sense that we think, but there are some timetables that come. For instance, the Daniel 9 prophecy tells us when the Messiah will come. Prophecies that say that the Messiah will come from the tribe of Judah. Prophecies like that. I see this great context that there is a supreme God who knows the future. And I think a lot of that can be established by good Thomistic arguments and such. And you bring all of this together, and you have a good case for resurrection. And you can make a case like this very briefly. I did it at my grandmother's funeral one time in about 5 minutes. I had 10 minutes to speak. I spent 5 of it giving a case for a resurrection. It can be done. This needs to be learned. We're going to take a somewhat longer break here. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back soon. The number is 714-242-5180.
Father, you can still get heaven on the line.
Number is 714-242-5180. And I've been talking right now about what I consider a crisis in the church, especially after the talk I had with some students recently, I believe it was Thursday, discussing inerrancy. And having students that are really wanting answers, and these students are facing professors in college asking them hard questions. And unfortunately, too many Christians are back at home and thinking, as long as I'm safe in my personal Christian subculture here, as long as no one's going after me, well, then everything's okay. That's not what we're called to. We are not called to hide from the culture. We are called to change the culture around us. And too often, we are changed by the culture around us instead. We are called to be salt and light in this world, and we have the means to do it. We have a huge number of us in America here today. We could do something with that if we really wanted to. If you want to know why the gospel isn't going to make much impact in America, it's because we don't want it to. We are not doing what it takes. We are hiding from the world instead of interacting with the world. And as long as we keep hiding in our literal Christian subcultures, we are not going to make any difference, and we will keep losing numbers more and more. And some of you might be of the opinion, well, if we can just have God take us out of here, then that'll be great. Now, look, I understand looking forward to being in the presence of Jesus. Every Christian should want that. But I can tell you, as much as I want it, I want to come into the presence of Jesus having done something. I want it to be that when I'm before Him, I will hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And I want it to be that if my wife and I have kids someday, that those kids will grow up in a world where they can freely be Christian. And if we don't, I want to grow up in a world where my friends' kids will have that right, where the next generation that's coming up will have that right. Friends, we have to get out of ourselves. I strongly suspect that most of the problems that we come across many times in our lives are because we are stuck in ourselves. It's here in America, it's our tendency. We make things all about us. Well, Christ is establishing His kingdom right now on this earth, and my kingdom is not about you. It's not about me either. But He has given us the opportunity to do something for His kingdom. And we ought to relish that opportunity. We ought to celebrate the fact that we get to serve Christ today. And we are living in what I think could be the golden age of apologetics. We have never had as much information as we have right now. For instance, in the Enlightenment, you want to get back to the historical Jesus and scrape away all this miraculous stuff and such. We don't need any of that. Let's just listen to the story of Jesus here and get the real message that the church has covered up for so long and find out who He was. Well, now we've got more and more historical research coming from scholars like N.T. Wright, who I've referenced earlier, that show, well, when we fit Jesus into a historical context, well, strangely enough, He seems to look a lot like the Jesus that we find in the New Testament. And then from the promo I played on here with my own father-in-law, Mike Lacona, he's written an excellent book demonstrating the case historically that Jesus rose from the dead. Those who don't know about that, that's the resurrection of Jesus, a new historiographical approach. And so this Enlightenment idea of if when we study history, it will demonstrate that Christianity is false. It's done nothing of the sort. History has become our friend. But it always was. We just needed to realize that. That if we apply tough standards even to Christianity, Christianity can pass. It can handle the questions. Because it's true. And what about science today? You know, we've got this big emphasis on everything has to be scientific. Well, there are so many ministries out there that are looking at science and showing that they think this does back Christianity, or at least theism. For instance, a lot of people in the intelligent design movement. Now, I'll go ahead and be blunt and say I'm not entirely sold on ID. I have some questions I wish to ask and such, and I'm not really one much for scientific apologetics a lot of times, and it could just be I don't speak the language of science. And since I'm not a scientist, then it's the area I don't cover. And I'll go to these scientific questions and say, okay, whatever it is, I'll grant it to you for the sake of argument. If you can establish it scientifically, you just have to deal with been with the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Because when a scientist says, for instance, that miracles can't happen, that's no longer doing science, that's doing philosophy. Science can't establish that miracles can never happen, or that miracles have never happened. Now, it could be the case that miracles can't happen or miracles have never happened, but it's not a question for science. It's a question for philosophy. But at least, I would say, the ID movement is getting us talking. And I can see that point. I mean, you got ministries like Hugh Ross, Reasons to Believe. I am a member of a local Reasons to Believe chapter, and that's because I want to be doing apologetics wherever I can, and even a ministry that deals with scientific objections and evidences for most still need some people that can deal with the other kinds of evidences. And that's when I jump on board. And in many ways, I do find some things fascinating. I don't discuss science as science, but I will talk about the history of science. I think an interesting work for my readers on this would be James Hannum's book, God's Philosophers, about science in the Middle Ages, because we've got this idea that the Middle Ages were essentially the Dark Ages, and there was no scientific advancement at the time. Absolutely bogus idea. Nonsense. There's even one atheist who thinks rather highly of himself, whose name I will not consider worth mentioning, who put up that graph that you can find online about how having a time line, and then Dark Ages, everything drops off, and then things pick up again around Galileo, and says, imagine, we could have been flying to the moon, flying throughout the solar system by now. Well, no. No, Galileo did not show up out of a vacuum. He grew up in a culture that was already practicing scientific inquiry more and more. In fact, you can check the atheist Tim O'Neill, his blog site that deals with this kind of thinking. And as far as I know, yeah, this guy's an atheist, he's not a Christian. And he's just saying the medieval period was a time of advancement. It's these same people who come out and say that everyone in that period thought the earth was flat. You would be hard-pressed to find one person who thought the earth was flat. It was known to be a sphere. In fact, most people could tell you its circumference. But this myth has been repeated so often that people have come to believe it without thinking about it. Now, again, back to the scientific statements, you got ministries like Reasons to Believe that are out there showing, well, here is the scientific evidence of the Big Bang, and the Big Bang theory is largely good evidence for a creator. Okay, now, I think there could be a lot of truth to that. I mean, the Big Bang argument doesn't entirely close the door. I mean, it's one reason why I don't think Bill Craig's first and second ways are entirely conclusive, but I think they certainly get you there. They just need metaphysical backing. Which also brings us to the area of philosophy. More and more philosophers are Christians. In fact, we are told now that the logical problem of evil has been dealt with. Now, that doesn't mean that evil isn't an objection anymore. It still is. There is the emotional problem of evil. It's pretty much conceded that evil, just by itself, is not enough to prove that God doesn't exist. But it's certain types of evil and such that are problematic. It's no longer enough to just stand up and say, there's evil, therefore God doesn't exist. You need more than that. You need a real argument. And so now we've got these philosophical arguments, and we've got philosophical giants like Alvin Plantinga, and that was like Eleanor Stump out there, giving these arguments. And we need to take these arguments and run with them. We need to see how many scholarly works are out there, and I'm hoping more and more in the future to get more and more scholarly guests on this program. And you need to be equipping yourself even when I'm not here, to help people like these college students that are having questions. Churches, unfortunately, too often have turned into self-help groups. Now, there is a time and place for that. I'm not saying the church needs to shut down its ministry for recovering alcoholics, or the church doesn't need to have a Weight Watchers Club meet at its doors, or anything like that. Those are fine. But remember, the church is supposed to give something that no one else in the world can give. And that's the gospel. And by that, I don't just mean the message of forgiveness. Forgiveness is part of the gospel. It's an important part of the gospel, but it's not the whole gospel. The whole gospel is about redemption entirely, and things are going to be redeemed entirely when the kingship of Christ is recognized throughout the world. And we are supposed to be the ones who have gone out of that message. We are going out with a message that Jesus is Lord. This is the Great Commission. It's what we've been told to do. We've been told to make disciples of all nations and baptize them. Note that. We are to make disciples. We are not to make converts. Something else I tell this group is we focus so much on converts that we think we get someone to save a prayer, and yes, glory, hallelujah, our work is done. You might as well say that a husband and wife go into the delivery room, the wife gives birth to a child, and says, glory, our work is done, honey, let's go off and do something else. Now, once that woman has given birth, her work has really just begun. In fact, so has the guy's work just begun, to be sure. And then the guys have a pretty easy part. Now they both have a difficult part. And that part is, they have to train up this child in a way that he should go, to quote Proverbs. And when we're going out making Christians, we don't just get them to come to Jesus and leave them there, as if everything is Jesus' responsibility. Remember, Paul told the Corinthians he fathered them through the gospel, and he was still teaching them. We have to go to these people that we've fathered through the gospel and still teach them. This is what Nabil had talked about earlier when he was our guest on the show. Said that Christians need to know, for instance, the doctrine of the Trinity. And unfortunately, too many Christians do have a modalist understanding of the Trinity. And is it any shock then when Jehovah's Witnesses show up and beat us up severely because we don't know what we're talking about? In fact, I've got some coming tomorrow. They're going to be at my house around 2. I'm not concerned about it. You know what? I know the doctrine. And I am ready to talk about it. And I'm pretty sure that's exactly what we're going to be talking about. And we will deal with it when it comes. But most Christians are just running away from these. Instead, they have these self-help groups. And the Bible, no one takes the time to see what the Bible means first. They want to ask, what does it mean to me? Every sermon is about personal application, Margie. And if it was up to me, I'd say every pastor, when preaching a sermon, they need to establish a foundation first. They need to set the context. They need to tell what's going on. They need to show anything historical. They can make any theological points, explain any textual problems of a text, anything of that sort. Get that out of the way. And then, once you've established what the text means to the original listeners, then you can say, you know, what does it mean in our lives today? If we skip to just what does the Bible mean to us today, we miss so much of God's message, because God's first message is what it meant then, what it means in its context. It's not just an application. You have to know what is really being said, in fact, before you can know how to apply it to your life. Well, we are going to take our final break. I am Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters podcast. Our number is 714-242-7900. 5180, and we will be back after this break.
This is Mike Licona. Nick Peters is my son-in-law, and I'm excited to announce his new podcast in which Nick will discuss and have guests on topics related to Christian apologetics and dealing with disabilities. Nick has already interviewed apologetic stars such as Greg Kokel and Rob Bowman, and I know of other stars he's in the process of inviting. So be sure to check out Nick's new podcast.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And thank you for those breaks, those promos and such. My number is 714-242-5180. That's 714-242-5180. We're on the air for about 19 more minutes. I'm Nick Peters, the host of the Deeper Waters podcast. And Mike, who did the promo, is absolutely right. We are working on getting many, many more guests. Right now, it's still a grab bag as to who's going to be on next week. I have some ideas, but there's nothing that's been settled in stone, so I can't tell you for sure yet. But I am going to get some guests who are going to be involved with the Unbelievable Conference taking place in England later this month. It's my hope I can get Justin Brierley to come on here sometime. And I'm hoping to get Kurt Jaros of Real Clear Apologetics. Both of them are playing an important part at a conference, and Unbelievable is one of the podcasts I listen to quite regularly. I try to not miss any episode of that. And I hope that you'll be listening to it, but I also hope you'll be listening to this podcast. And with regards to donations, yes, we need them. One of the best ways you can support evangelism other than prayer is by donating to those of us who are out here trying to equip the saints. I saw something today about Benny Hinn wanting to raise up $2.5 million from his followers to get out of debt. It really saddens me that televangelists and people who are these proven frauds so often get so much support from their listeners, their followers, and those of us who are out here on the front lines don't seem to get anything. And when the church spends enough on apologetics ministries, I think, as it does on these self-help ministries, the church will thrive even more. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong with donating to ministries that help you out in other ways. Make sure they're good Orthodox ministries. But this ministry, I would hope, is one that you would want to support. Of course, Blog Talk Radio needs your support, but so does Deeper Waters individually. Now, if you want to support Deeper Waters, you can do that for our sister ministry of Tectonics. Just go to their donate page and include, hey, I'm making this donation for Nick Peters or for Deeper Waters. And your donation will then be tax deductible. If you're not sure about how to do that one, you can just go to our blog, deeperwaters.wordpress.com, and click the donate button, and you can make a donation that way. And I've said this on the air before. I was told at the start we'd be syndicated to about 20,000 listeners out there. And this is how little is really needed to help the apologetics ministries, and how your giving can make such a difference. If we had 20,000 people listening to this program, and each of those listeners donated $1 to Deeper Waters a year, we would have more than enough to do what we need to do. Really, think about that. If everyone could give $1 a year, now imagine what we could do if we gave so much more consistently. And when you're famous, you have to ask, what really is worth giving more to than to the kingdom of God on earth? And this isn't just my ministry. Okay? I want to make it be that all this is going to just support me as if I'm the only trooper out there doing the work. No, this is pretty much every apologetics ministry out there. We need you. We need you to help us out. And we need you to help us out for the sake of your kids, especially. The students that I met at this college group who were asking these questions, and they weren't very sure about how to do their evangelism. For instance, one of them said to me that, well, what I find as a clincher is what Jesus has done for me. And that's the argument that I give. So, okay, let's do that, okay, then? You're sitting at home one day, you're thinking about what Jesus has done for you. There's a knock on your door. These guys in black pants and white shirts, and they've got these name badges on, and they say, Elder so-and-so of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they want to talk with you. And they say, well, we have this book, the Book of Mormon, and we know it is true because we have a burning in the bosom from the Holy Spirit that tells us it's true. And so I said to this Christian, I said, now, what you're going to tell them is, when my personal experience tells me Jesus Christ or Christianity is true. And I would say, well, why should you discount our personal experience because of your personal experience? Why should your personal experience be given precedence instead of ours? And that would be a very good question. When two people come with different personal experiences, how are we going to determine which one is right and which one is wrong? If all we look at is the experience itself, we will never find an answer. We have to look at the claims. So why do we reject the Book of Mormon? Because of a lack of evidence for it. We don't find these Mormon cities here in America. We don't find Mormon artifacts. We don't find anything. We find nothing but problems with the Book of Mormon. And it gets even worse when we get into books like the Doctrine and Covenants. And then, of course, there's the big Achilles heel of Mormonism in many ways, the Book of Abraham, which Egyptologists across the board will say Joseph Smith did not translate the Book of Abraham correctly, since it's not even the Book of Abraham. This is known. This can be established quite easily. And then we can say to the Mormon, now instead, compare this to the evidence of Jesus risen from the dead. Because when we're talking with people like Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, I want people to be very careful to realize one of the first things we need to establish is the reliability of the Bible. If you don't do that, I think you're on your way to creating a fundamentalist atheist. Because they will abandon Mormonism or the Watchtower, and with it they will abandon theism altogether. Like I said, we need to give more than our experience. And a lot of you do have your testimony, but when you're coming up to the atheist, it's not going to work. Now, am I saying your testimony is absolutely useless? No. But I would say put it in a deeper context. C.S. Lewis put it this way. He said, when you're going out doing evangelism with your church and you knock on someone's door, let your arguers come forward first. That would be people like me. These people will deal with the intellectual barricades that are keeping people from Christianity. After that, then you have other people come up who are better at testimonials and say, and this is the difference that Jesus Christ has made in my life. That, I think, is a proper way to do it. Because if you go the other way, then people can say, well, that's nice for you. And I'm so happy you found something that works for you, but I'm just going to go my own way. Now, the claim of Jesus is not just about changing your life. The claim of Jesus is he is Lord of the universe based on his resurrection from the dead. And that is what needs to be established more than anything else. And that will be established by doing the study of history. And this is what Christians need to do. We need to ask ourselves, like I've been saying, the hard questions. Lately I've been doing something at night when I'm going to sleep. Maybe some of you are like me, and some of you could have had a hard time falling asleep in such. And for me, it's largely because my mind is just always running. My wife says I'm just a bundle of energy, and she has no idea where I get all this energy from. Quite frankly, neither do I. If I even get just 2 or 3 hours of sleep in one day, I can still go through the next day, put in a 4 day's work, and do pretty darn good at it. But when I'm going to rest, I'll just start asking myself questions about the Bible. Now, recently I had read Scott McKnight's book, The King Jesus Gospel, and wanted to think more about how the Old Testament story applies to Jesus. But before you get to how it applies to Jesus, what do we do first? That's right. We look and see what the Old Testament story in itself is. So I said, you know what, tonight I'm just going to think about the books of the Old Testament and go through them until I get to Jesus. That sounded good. I started doing this maybe a month or so ago. I'm still in Genesis. Okay, I'm still asking myself these questions. Like last night, it said, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I decided to go back even to that verse at the start and think about it. I said, okay, in the beginning. In the beginning of what? Are we talking about the beginning of time? Or the beginning of a story? And we have to be clear. We don't want to come with our assumptions beforehand. You know, I think the material universe as a whole was created at one point, but I want to make sure, is that what Genesis is talking about? Maybe it's not talking about the beginning of time. Maybe it's just talking about the beginning of the story. Maybe it's talking about both. I have to ask the question to know. And then you say, God. Okay, what do we mean by this? So, you know, this is the first time God's mentioned, and you don't get told anything about the nature of God explicitly. Now, you're told he's the creator at this point, which tells you some things, but God's not defined, really. In fact, there really isn't one doctrine of God I can think of laid out in all the Bible. You have to go throughout the whole thing and take all the pieces together, and even then, you don't get the total picture. You never could get the total picture, because God's much greater than that. And ask, what is going on? This passage just jumps in there immediately, and boom, there's God. And keep in mind, this would have been held in contrast to the polytheistic religions that would tell you not just about the origins of the universe, but the origins of the gods themselves. And the Genesis account, it doesn't do that. It doesn't give you the story of how God came into being, because to the Genesis account, ultimately, that's nonsense, I think. It's just God has been there. And then we find that God created. Now, we have to ask ourselves a question. Does that mean what we think it means? Does it mean that God brought everything into existence at one point? Now, I think he did. But is that what Genesis is telling us? Next month, we're going to have John Walton come on here to talk about the lost world of Genesis 1. And he's going to be saying that no, creation means something different. Now, he's not going to deny that God created a material world in the sense that we think of it. But he is going to say perhaps the sense we're usually thinking about it is not the sense the ancient Jew would have heard. So we think with a scientific mindset. But with the ancient Jew, who was Moses' main audience at that time, would they have thought with a scientific mindset? I really don't think so. And then, the heavens and the earth. What is that? It's called a merism. And what it is, it's a statement where you mention two things that are quite opposite, and what's meant by those two things is meant to include everything in between. North and south, east and west. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It doesn't mean Adam and Eve did not know what good was and did not know what evil was. It was meaning that they would be all-knowing. They would know all wisdom. I'm not sure if that serpent meant every single fact about the universe, but he said, you will be wise. Which is why Eve took the fruit, because she thought it was good to make wise. And so this isn't just saying that God created earth and then he created heaven. And even if we did say that, what do we mean by heaven? Do we mean the third heaven where Paul went to in 2 Corinthians 12? Do we mean the heaven where God dwells? Do we mean just the sky? Does it mean all of those? How do we know? Look, these are a lot of questions, and I got those questions just from the first verse of the Bible. Imagine whatever questions you can ask about the rest of the Bible. And I didn't even ask that point. What does that tell me about Jesus? I'm not going to get to that yet. I'm going to just know what does the text mean to begin with. Yes, eventually we will get to what does the text say about Jesus. But before we know what the text means to us today, and before we even know what it meant to the apostles and what it meant to the early church, we have to know what it meant to its original readers. Why did Moses write what he wrote? If you think Moses wrote the text, I happen to think Moses did write Genesis. But if you don't, you still have to ask, why did the author put that in there? You know what? If we are asking ourselves these hard questions about the Bible beforehand, we will be the ones who are prepared when our skeptic friends come to us, who really aren't asking a lot of the hard questions they've thought of because they've been opening their Bibles and reading the text and grappling with it and seeking to understand what it means. Now, a lot of them have just been getting it from all these skeptical websites that don't really know how to do any real Bible study. If we know how to do real Bible study, we will be ahead of the game. And real Bible study is more than just finding out what the text means to me. It's more than just finding out how I can deal with my own problems from a text. Real Bible study says, I want to know what God has said already. I want to know what he said to his people in the past, and I want to know what that means for us today. And for our youth in the church, we need to give them the freedom to ask these questions. And after they ask these questions, we need to be giving them answers. For each student that I spoke to at this meeting Thursday, there are several more there who are silent. And what's going to happen to them? What, some of them are going to fall away. They're going to find other things that interest them more. They'll be out having premarital sex. They'll be doing drugs. They'll be going to drinking parties. And why shouldn't they if a church isn't giving them anything whatsoever? If all the church can do is give them strong emotions, why should they bother? Because they can get those in many other places, and they can have a lot more fun in their minds doing it. Now, ultimately, I do think the most joy does lie in the Christian life. That's when it's lived authentically, and when it's lived according to the true teachings of Jesus and the true teachings of Scripture. And if we're going to know what those are, there aren't any shortcuts. We're going to have to study. We're going to have to sacrifice. We are going to have to break out of our shells and get out of ourselves. Well, that's been my little rant for today. We are winding down in time here, so I am going to be going ahead and ending things. I hope next week we have a guest in relation to the Unbelievable Conference, but I won't know for sure. If you're friends with me on Facebook, you can follow that way and see what's coming up. But for now, I am Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast, and I'm signing off.